From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's Friday night, and we're talking about the life and legacy of former Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir, now brought to stage.
Golda Meir for tonight, telling you a handful of my stories. I'll be a long time dead and forgotten, and who'll care about me or my stories? But they lead up to one terrible question, which won't die. I'm at the end of my stories. I'm old, I'm tired, I'm sick. The picture you have of me is Mama Lagolda, who makes chicken soup for her soldiers. It's a nice picture, and I do make chicken soup. But let's empty it all out for keeps. Right now, at the bottom of the pot is blood. At the bottom of the pot is the question. I'll begin at the beginning.
Actress Annette Miller, opening William Gibson's one-woman play, Golda's Balcony. And for the next 95 minutes, we explore the heart and soul of a nation, a woman, a wife, a mother, and a leader under fire. Golda Meir was born in Kiev, raised in Milwaukee, drawn to Palestine and on to the front lines of Israel's rise to statehood. Golda's Balcony is anchored in Prime Minister Meir's deepest hour of crisis in 1973 in the Yom Kippur War, when Egypt and Syria made a surprise attack on the Jewish state, and Meir was calling desperately for military equipment from the United States. In the hours of her wait and terrifying game of nuclear threat with Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon, Golda's Balcony opens the grand and excruciating vista of a singular woman's life and a singular people's dreams. Her anguished questions resonate deeply today. What happens when idealism becomes power? And who has the right to exist where? Tonight we'll talk about the life of Golda Meir and the dilemmas in power and dreams, and we will hear scenes from Golda's Balcony. Joining me in the studio tonight is Annette Miller, the one-woman star of Golda's Balcony. Good evening and welcome, Annette.
Good evening.
Wonderful to have you. And Daniel Gaudron, the play's director who lived in Israel during the Yom Kippur War. Good evening, Daniel Gaudron.
Good evening.
And with us from Stockbridge, Massachusetts tonight, we're joined by William Gibson, the playwright of Golda's Balcony, along with many other plays, including The Miracle Worker. William Gibson, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for being with us. And so here we are. I was delighted to get to see this on stage just yesterday. It's just terrific, and it brings such a world, a mind, a history to mind. Annette, you're fabulous in bringing this woman. We all have such a powerful picture of Golda Meir, and you draw it to mind in your very first reading there with talk of Mama the Golda and the pot of chicken soup, and we know that face with its unapologetic creases and wrinkles and that great hair with its gray, and you don't pretend to be any of that, and yet you bring it all right there. What's it like to try and inhabit, to so effectively convey this woman, Golda?
It's a challenge. It's something that I actually look forward to every evening. It's invigorating. It's not tiring. I feel privileged to be able to bring her to the stage and a little bit concerned about, am I really doing this? And I feel I am. And each night, I can only say, each time I do it, it gets deeper and deeper for me.
She's a towering figure. The expectations of your audience are large.
Yes, they are. I guess I don't think about that. I think more about what she has to do, what her task is, and where she is at this point of her life, which is examining her life. And this is something that's a good thing to do every now and then, to examine one's life.
William Gibson, take us to the beginning that Annette Miller spoke of in your line, in the play, in her first reading there, but the beginning of your interaction with this theme, with this story, with this woman, Golda Meir.
Well, my interaction involves many other historical incidents of power and what happens when it exercises itself in very complex situations that require choices between equally impossible alternatives. So that although this is the story of an Arab-Israeli confrontation in Israel, the real point for me is a study of power and the people who exercise it. And through one woman whom I knew personally a little bit, Golda, through a portrait of her character, because basically the play is the portrait of a woman. Mm-hmm. But through that woman, you see the history of a country and the kind of dilemma that all people in positions of power inevitably find themselves confronted with.
Whether a woman, whether a mother or not, the same dilemmas come. And the dilemma at its bottom, as we heard the allusion already in the first words, Annette Miller reading, the dilemmas come down to life and death decisions.
Yes, indeed.
Daniel Gaudron, many of our listeners will know the history of Golda Meir. Many may not. Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of her life?
Oh, boy.
Born in Kiev, and we hear in the play how pogroms were part of her family's life, born in 1898.
Yeah. Came to the States as a child.
Mm-hmm. Wisconsin, in
yeah,
Milwaukee.
Yeah, in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. And then went to Denver and met her husband there. Went to Palestine in 1921.
Very early on.
Yeah. She met Ben-Gurion before that in the States and was very influenced by Ben-Gurion.
This, of course, was in the days when the Zionist movement was recruiting support from around the world, was churning up the kind of enthusiasm and belief that this could be done.
She was very much a very strong Zionist. Came to Palestine, started working for the labor, the Histadrut and the party. And I mean, I grew up with her because I was born in Israel, mm-hmm. I always knew she was always there. She was ambassador. After the establishment of the state, she was ambassador.
Sent to Moscow right away.
Yeah, in Moscow.
Mm-hmm. She was labor minister, wasn't she? And then joined the Knesset?
Yeah. She became foreign minister because Ben-Gurion said she doesn't know anything about foreign policy, so it's okay, we'll give her foreign policy.
But she knew a lot about the United States, at least the people having grown up there.
She knew a lot about it anyway. And then retired and was called back, actually, when Eshkol died in 69, she was mm-hmm. called back and asked to become prime minister.
The play Golda's Balcony centers then on, hours, days, when she's just at the horrible cutting edge of the surprise attack by Egypt and Syria, wrestling with what to do, with how to respond, with how far she's willing to go to respond. But to understand that moment, we want to roll the tape back and understand something about her beginning. I'd love to hear a little bit of the conversation. And, of course, Annette, I should point out, for people who haven't seen it, it's Annette Miller inhabiting Golda throughout and taking us back and forth from the urgent meetings where she's discussing, she's on the phone with Kissinger, she's railing about Moshe Dayan, and then she's reminiscing and bringing back to life earlier pieces of her life. Daniel Gaudron, can you set up this scene where she's having a conversation? Just set it up for us with her father in Milwaukee. What's going on here before we hear the reading?
Oh, she's actually having a conversation with Morris, who came to proposed to her.
Oh, who will be her husband,
and,
that's right.
Yeah, and she's talking to him, and the father barges in because she was making speeches from soapboxes outside the synagogue, against the pogroms and stuff like that, and he is furious because it's not nice for a nice Jewish girl to be doing that.
So this would be Milwaukee circa...
Probably she was 17 or so.
So the 19-teens.
Yes, 19-teens, right.
Annette Miller, let us hear it.
My father came in, shaking a handful of leaflets, hollering, Goldie! I said, Papa, this is a spectacle you're making of me. Morris Myerson, no daughter of Moshe Mabovich on a soapbox outside the synagogue is making speeches. I said, look, in the synagogue they don't let me talk. And Papa said, when you're a man, you'll talk in the synagogue. So wait, you hear? I said, I'm talking tonight, Papa. All the comrades are meeting me there. I'll meet you there, Papa said, and drag you home in the street by the braids. Papa, I promised. You heard it? Tonight you stay home or by the braids. Happy to meet you, Maya. Morris said, Morris. Papa said, whatever, and went out. Well, I said to Morris, the thing is, I don't want to be Morris's wife, and I don't want not to be Morris's wife. Morris said, it's a bit contradictory. I mean, women live so small, stuck in the kitchen, and outside the whole world is calling us to come change it. For the better? Of course for the better. How can I just make matzo balls? This year in Pinsk, by the old church, Petlura stood the Jews up and shot them. Families we knew. Morris said, it's very different here. Here, we'll disappear. And marry you here, I'll disappear. The women there are plowing the land. Morris said, women where? In Palestine. Pioneers. New women. Morris said, you want to go to Palestine? Yes, not be just a parlor Zionist. And not marry me. I said, I want to marry you and go to Palestine.
She wants to have it all. And, of course, we hear in this passage the reference to Meyerson, which was the name at her birth. Ben-Gurion later persuaded her to change it to make it more
Hebrew sounding.
It was
her married name.
Oh, a married name, of course. Yeah. Excuse me. Yes.
Yeah, it was Morris Meyerson was her husband.
And then in the 1950s, 56. Actually.
1956.
He changed it to Meir.
And Golda Meir is suddenly there. William Gibson, you go right to the heart in these lines of her struggle over not only wanting to have a life that would be difficult to put into normal domestic terms, but a struggle about gender. Her father says, when you're a man, you'll talk in the synagogue. This is a woman who's not going to buy that.
Yes, and I don't think that's, you know, solely Golda's experience.
Certainly not.
My wife is a psychoanalyst, and she's devoted her life to that, the practice of that art or science, and at times has had to choose between family and patients. Mm-hmm. So it's a very common choice in this century. It wasn't a choice for my mother. My mother just wanted to get married and raise a family and run the house, clean the house, buy the food and stuff, and she did that. It was a full-time job. I don't imagine any high school girl in America now thinks that's a prospective future.
But it's remarkable that Golda Meir was not willing to think in those terms. She would not be dragged home by the brakes.
There have been extraordinary women throughout history who haven't obeyed, the dictates of that sexual role. Yes.
William Gibson, as you followed her career on into the real depths of struggle, into the heights of power, how did her gender continue to play out? Was it always a factor, or at some point does it dissolve away and she's left facing, in the same way any other person would, male or female, the dilemmas of power, the dilemmas of dreams?
I think that she was shaken to her bottom by the Yom Kippur War, and in her alleged autobiography, which she didn't write, of course, but in that she says, and she must have okayed these statements, she said, after the war I knew I would never be the same woman again. Mm-hmm. And I think that was true. Now, I didn't know her before. I've met her a few years after the 73 war, mm-hmm. and so I can't answer your question with any personal knowledge, but it seems to me that her dedication to the ideal was basic and unshakable, and everything else was subordinated to that, but she felt very, very guilty about that fact.
Her marriage did not last.
It did not last, and nobody knows why. I think I know why, but it's just my guess.
What's your guess, William Gibson?
What is my guess?
Yes.
A woman once told me, when marriages break up, it's either sex or money or both. Now, I think there was a sexual problem, and I don't think there was a money problem, but I think instead of money, there was the sense of her fascination with creating a state for Jews, and she became what I called somewhere, instead of a fur-bearing animal, a state-bearing animal. Yeah. That became her principal sense of vitality in her own life, and everything that was subordinated to that had to go by the boards. And that's, I think, the explanation of why the marriage didn't last.
And
those
so,
two things.
And so Morris Meyerson did not become Dennis Thatcher to her Maggie Thatcher, but was shed, and she went on to lead. We've got to take a short break. Annette Miller, Danielle Gaudron, William Gibson in Stockbridge, please stand by. We'll be right back with much more about Golda's Balcony and the life of Golda Meir. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about The play by William Gibson, Golda's Balcony, about the life and the dilemmas of a life lived by Golda Meir, Prime Minister of Israel, whose darkest hour perhaps came in the Yom Kippur War, 1973, but whose life spanned the creation of Israel and so much more than that drama. I'm joined tonight by William Gibson from Stockbridge, Massachusetts, the author, the playwright of Golda's Balcony, also of The Miracle Worker and Two for the Seesaw, by Daniel Gaudron, who's directing the production currently in Boston, and Annette Miller, the one-woman star of Golda's Balcony. William Gibson, you point out that there are universal dilemmas of power and dreaming that run throughout this play and throughout the life of Golda Meir, but there were specific dilemmas, of course, were and are, in the case of Israel, Palestine. I've read your reference to Max Nordau saying to his friend, Theodor Herzl, who, of course, was key to the Zionist movement, saying, by the way, Herzl, you know, there are Arabs in Palestine. This will not be easy, and therein, today, and certainly in Golda Meir's time, was the central conflict, the central dilemma.
I think it was typical of all the Zionists. They didn't foresee this problem as being a lifelong problem. They thought they could return to the promised land and they could occupy a little bit here and there. And in the beginning, they did. Before statehood, they paid money to acquire farms, to establish kibbutzim. And they didn't think that was I don't think anybody had the foresight to see what they would end up with. Now, the vision of Israel as a homeland implies domestic security of some kind. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that from even before statehood, actually, as Golda points out at one point, there were Arab attacks. The Arabs did not want the Jews in there. Mm-hmm. And after statehood, this became then regional war to the death, and it has not ceased being that, despite many peace efforts in between. I don't think if you had spoken to Golda when she was 18 and thinking of going to Palestine, if you had said you're going to end up in charge of a war involving the possible deaths of millions of people, I think she would have dropped dead.
But she didn't, and she stood up years later. But that was the surprise. That was not the expectation, as you say.
No, but bit by bit, mm-hmm. it accretes. Mm-hmm. And as the presence of Jews in that land multiplied, mm-hmm. of course, the problem multiplied. And I don't think Herzl had the faintest idea that there would be a century of war following the return to Zion.
Daniel Gaudron, for a while, simply populating Palestine or what would be Israel with Jews was a challenge in itself. After the war, it was still under the British mandate. The British were very restrictive on who would come and how. There's a scene in the play, and Miller, I hope you'll read it for us in a moment, but set us up. Here's where the Jews have gone through what we all know they've gone through, the Holocaust in Europe. Now there are a camp in Cyprus and...
Yeah, this is right after the Second World War mm-hmm. and after the Holocaust. There were lots of refugees trying to come to Palestine. There was British white paper that allowed very few Jewish mm-hmm. immigrants in. And they would stop the immigrants by shiploads and put them in a concentration camp, for want of a better word.
So you essentially had that in Cyprus, people waiting to be allowed to go on.
Yeah.
And Golda Meir comes...
40,000 of them, she says, including children, and the British allowed 750 to leave. And Golda was sent, because it was her department in the Jewish agency, she was sent to Cyprus.
In this passage, we'll hear Annette Miller reading, it comes to the kind of dilemmas and the ongoing sacrifices people are asked to make, even coming out of the war and all that entailed. Annette Miller.
Always we were ruled by others. First the Turks, who banished Jews from Palestine, so we fought with the British against them. Then we were ruled by the British under a mandate. And on the island of Cyprus, after Hitler, they ran a concentration camp for Jews. Being polite to the Arabs with all that oil. Jews, war refugees, sailing to us by the thousands, were stopped mid-ocean and caged up in Cyprus. Some 40,000, including children. And the British allowed 750 a month to leave. We had Jewish agency doctors there who said they couldn't answer if the children spent another winter on Cyprus. My department in the agency, I negotiated with the British High Commissioner until at last he gave me a letter and I went to Cyprus with it. The commandant there was to let me tour the camps. Huts and tents were thrown together on the bare hot sand, with watchtowers and guards with rifles, and the DPs, displaced persons, in their rags, pressed up against all the barbed wire fences to see me. There was a committee for each camp, and a committee of the committees that I met with. In Yiddish, I said, "I've come about the children. We know how many have died here." And the chairman challenged me. "How many?" I said, 48. He said, 49 today. I said, "It's the winter that worries us. We think they won't get through it. The doctors tell us there's dysentery in the huts. Of course, no water. And an epidemic isn't out of the question." So one woman said, "So get us out!" I said, "Every last one on the day we have a state." Another woman said, "I'm on next month's quota. Do you have children?" She said, "It's my one blessing. No." "Then it's you I came to ask," I said. "Will you let a child go in your place?" Everyone got very quiet. The woman said, "It's first in, first out." I said, "The British will waive that if you do." The woman said, I'm 19 months here. I'm sick myself. You want me to die here?" Should I have said yes? The chairman said, "You'll have to go to each hut." So I did. All next day. I said, "Insult you, I won't. We don't know what you've been through." And to one girl who must have been pretty once, "What camp were you in?" She said, "Bergen-Belsen." I was looking at the number on her arm when she pulled it behind her. "No." Another said, "The officer's whore." The girl jumped up to leave, and I said, "I promise you, in Eretz Israel, everything is new." Which stopped her. I said, "It begins now." She said, "How?" I said, "Let a child go." Somebody else said, "So people have waited a year for their quota stay? Somebody who came with a child last week leaves? That's what you're asking?" I said, "That's what I'm asking." A little knot of children adopted me, told me their names. "Good," I said. "Be my bodyguard." And they led me between the huts. In one, I ran into the chairman again, who said, "It's all we've been talking about since yesterday. Maybe we'll disappoint you." So they warned me at the agency beforehand. These detainees would never listen to me. The one thing they wanted was to get out of Cyprus. And in the last hut, a woman was savage with me. "I vote yes. You got my vote. Now go away." And when I took her by the elbow, she said, "I killed my baby," and broke free. The woman next to her said she was hiding in the sewer with a group. The Nazis were above. The baby started crying. She smothered it. Yes, I knew that story. Such stories. The detainees had an outdoor meeting for me to talk at. I said, "We'll have a state. Someday we'll have a state. You came from the DP camps, Germany and France. You remember how in every schoolroom there was a map of Palestine. The children learnt its geography, sang its songs, talked of arriving." And the teacher said, "Without this map, the children would lose hope." 15,000 children went into the death camps at Terezin. 100 came out. "If we lose the children, we lose the future. We lose being a people. But here and now, lose these children, and we lose these children. It's up to you."
Annette Miller, reading the part of Golda Meir from Golda's Balcony by playwright William Gibson. Jenny Gaudron, you're the director. Directing a one-woman play is a very intimate undertaking. Give us some sense. I mean, we can hear in Annette Miller's reading her intuitive sense of this woman, but you must have had conversation after conversation. How do you direct toward this combination of compassion and power, of common sense and zeal? What's the advice that you've streamed to your actress?
You just work together. I mean, we know each other for a long time, and we trust each other, which is a prerequisite for this kind of work. I mean, we're working one-on-one, and there's no other distractions, really.
It's nobody else's fault.
No. And with an actress like Annette, who can turn on a dime, all you need is give her a hint. You give her a hint, and she takes it and runs with it. So a lot of times, you basically, what you need to do is arrange it, whittle it down, actually, and say, you don't really need that much here. Save yourself for this moment. You can't let it spill.
No, you can't. And Annette, what's harder, getting the woman, the mother, or getting the wielder of power?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's fascinating. I was concerned. I thought to myself, who am I to play someone who would absolutely have, you know, that kind of power over a state,
mm-hmm.
life and death, and motherhood I knew. Mm-hmm. So the hardest part, I think, for me, mm-hmm. was to actually let myself go with that power, which I certainly had within me, mm-hmm. and not to get sentimental with the softer parts and
to convey the ruthlessness that at a certain point's required.
Well, I don't want to say ruthlessness. No, I think the passion that is required and which passion comes first. And I think for her, as Bill said, the passion for this state that would be mm-hmm. a place for Jews to always have as a homeland so they would no longer be refugees mm-hmm. after the 2,000 years of exile was such an important passion for her mm-hmm. that she was able to many times make decisions that were difficult for a mother. But she does say that any woman who has to see her life outside of just mm-hmm. her children will be a woman who's never at rest. And she has said that.
And as William Gibson points out, at some point, when you sit as the head of a state with all those lives at stake, the line between passion and ruthlessness can become a very, very fine one indeed. We want to hear more. Daniel Gaudron, set up this moment, I guess it's 1948, when Golda Meir goes to Jordan and she's talking with the king. What's going on? What's at stake here?
She is sent by Ben-Gurion to visit King Abdullah in Transjordan mm-hmm. and to beg for peace. And she was sent...
That is, when we become an independent state, please don't attack us.
This is after the UN voted to partition already, mm-hmm. and it's a few days before Israel is going to declare itself mm-hmm. as a state. Ben-Gurion sent her in secret, mm-hmm. and she was dressed as a Muslim wife.
And here, I guess, in this conversation, choices are made on both sides. Annette Miller.
I have to say she started with saying that we never, never wanted the fighting. 5 days before statehood, Ben-Gurion sent me to Transjordan, begging for peace of King Abdullah himself. In secret, my guide Ezra dressed me with robes and a veil. I was to be a Muslim wife. Who else knew? Only Ben-Gurion. Ezra said, the king will be discreet. It's worth his life, too. And then in comes Abdullah. Mm-hmm. I took off the veil. I said, I can't talk through a veil. Abdullah smiled. Progressive, yes. You Jews have been so innovative in Palestine, bringing the swamps and deserts to life. Share your secrets with us. I said, it's one secret. For 2,000 years, pray. Next year, in Jerusalem. Of course, Abdullah said. Only the spirit makes the world fruitful. I said, work doesn't hurt. Abdullah said, you know, my belief that Allah scattered the Jews throughout the West, that they may bring its knowledge back to us, since we are all the children of Shem. And look, I said, in 5 days it's war, and the children will murder each other. You're breaking your promise to me? Because he had promised he would not join the Arab League against us. In the fall, he sent me a message. He was a Bedouin, and so a man of honor. And a king besides. And a promise to a woman he would never break. That promise, Abdullah said, I made in November, before the UN vote to partition. Then I was alone. Now I am one of five nations and no longer master of my own destiny. My brothers of the Arab states see the Jews returning as Europeans, no longer Semites, but invaders. I said, yes. Their view we heard from our brother, the head of the Arab League. This will be a war of extermination, a momentous massacre like the Mongol massacres. Abdullah said, so it will be. Mrs. Myerson, you can avert this disaster. I'd love to, I said. How? So he made me a different offer. Do not proclaim your state. Why are you in such a hurry? I said, 2,000 years I can't call a hurry. Wait one more, he said. I will annex Palestine, not partitioned, merge it with Jordan, and after a year the Jews will sit in my parliament. I said, as a minority. Proportionally, he said. I will treat you very well, protect you. I said, like the Germans? 50 years you've seen us here, fighting this stony land, the Arab riots, the British army. There isn't a Jew among us who didn't give sweat or blood. But to sit again in somebody else's parliament, that isn't what we dreamed. It is a dream, Abdullah said. I offer you a compromise that is realizable. Bring me an answer by May 15th to take to my Arab friends, and we can live in peace. Peace today, tomorrow, the ovens. I said, I can answer now. If it's war, we'll fight some more. Abdullah said, it means the ruin of everything you've achieved in these 50 years. And we'll win, I said. Kenahara. Abdullah smiled. Yes, it's your duty to fight. Is there anything more to be said? I stood up and said only, Shalom. Abdullah stood up, bowed, and said, Salam. There is so narrow a difference in how we say peace. I said, how many Jewish bodies will you bury in it?
Annette Miller, reading from William Gibson's one-woman play, Golda's Balcony. William Gibson, how far has that conversation between Arab and Jew advanced since that moment?
I think it has deteriorated, not advanced. If we were to take off from Abdullah, who was, I believe, the great-grandfather of the present Jordanian king, if we were to take off from his view, we would have some kind of civilized dialogue between the two groups. Mm-hmm. But that no longer seems possible. It has the chances for peaceful negotiations, I think, have not advanced at all. I think they are worse now than they were in that conversation.
We're talking tonight about Golda Meir and the play Golda's Balcony. We're going to come to a climactic moment in that story right after this break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are tonight in the midst of a wonderful one-woman play, excerpts therefrom, Golda's Balcony, written by William Gibson, who's joining us tonight from Stockbridge, Massachusetts, by Annette Miller, who plays Golda Meir in the play Golda's Balcony, and by the director, Daniel Gidron. We've been hearing about the life of this woman, this mother, this leader, and the play leads toward, is built around this climactic moment when she's faced with invasion by Egypt and Syria. This is October 1973, the Yom Kippur War. She was later deeply criticized for not being fully prepared for this war, and it's very clear in the play that Israel is at threat. The word she's getting from her generals is, we're not sure we can stop this. Daniel Gidron, she's desperate for arms from Washington, and much of it is built around that conversation, waiting, 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 needing.
Yeah, and at one point, she pulls in the big gun, and she's horrified by what she has to do.
But this, she's essentially, explicitly or implicitly, the threat on the table is,
if we don't get relief, if we don't
that
get...
That is, fighter jets and...
Yeah, and replacement of everything that we lost.
Yes.
Then we'll have to do the unthinkable.
That is, use the nuclear weapon, which...
Well,
but exactly there, in that ambiguity, sits the threat, sits the menace, sits what she has to grapple with, and for a while, the whole world.
Yeah, but this is really the culminating point for the play, and this is where she starts really, in the wait, she starts re-examining her life. So I see it, at least, mm-hmm. that the whole play happens within that moment of waiting, the day of waiting, you know, as a kind of a nightmare, waiting for a phone call from Washington.
Annette Miller, let us hear.
Our little war wasn't taking place in a bottle. It was a piece of the Cold War for world control. I waited all day. The whole cabinet waited long into the night for word from Kissinger and Nixon. Kissinger was already juggling problems all over the world. And now, here on his doorstep, was a vision of doomsday dawning in Jerusalem. In our eyes, too, worst of all, the power was ours. And the choice. What choice? Did I even think of saying, let Israel die? I was physically sick. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't eat. I had nothing in my stomach but was vomiting all day. Just dry retching and retching. You know, what was I thinking? A mishmash. My dream was simple. Make a new world. 1917-18. We were rid of the Kaiser and the Tsar. No more tyrants. Now only peace and socialism. Oh, like a young girl this century was. Such a beauty. And so much evil in her. Stalin. The Depression. Hitler, the war, the Holocaust, the atom bomb. What happens when idealism becomes power? To save a world you create. And this is the terrible question. How many worlds are you entitled to destroy? Tell me, my hypothetical friend, in this grain of earth that you made, good and evil are like two ends of a single stick. So nobody picks up one without the other. Why?
Top secret.
And so it is top secret because it's almost unimaginable. William Gibson, you posed the question, help us explore it. Help us understand it. What does happen when idealism becomes power?
It stops being idealism. Idealism is based upon an ignorance of the complexities of choices that exist in real politics, where the true slogan is the art of the possible. And the idealism, which we have seen throughout the ages, run into the same kind of obstacle that Goals' adolescent idealism runs into here. That's a standard experience. There is no answer to her question. The answer to her question is, this is what happens. It will always happen. We always have to keep trying to overcome it, because to try to overcome it is part of our nature and inevitability also. So you will always have the struggle between what is and what should be.
And the follow-on question, then.
Wow.
We can use more of this wisdom. What about it, William Gibson? To save a world you create, how many worlds are you entitled to destroy?
I don't know the answer. If I knew the answer, I would have written it in.
And what a play it would be. But as you say, as you have her say, I started out to make this state a model for redemption. That's the ideal. Annette Miller, in the lines as you read them, do you sense her feeling that ideal slip away? William Gibson says it must. It's the meaning of power, that idealism slips away.
Well, I think she is questioning it. I think that she is, she understood, she says at one point, all the idealism went into the making of a state. Power. She knew that in order to at least begin to have some of the ideals that she wanted, we have to have a state to be able to do that. And the big question at the end is why, and it's top secret. God's got a secret up there. He's not telling us why he's made that same stick, good and evil. But maybe he is telling us, we got to work it out. That's our job on this earth.
William Gibson, at the very top of the play, we heard Annette Miller reading your lines, Golda Meir saying, look, I'm not just Mama La Golda, just making chicken soup for the soldiers. And then telling us right at the top that at the bottom of that pot of chicken soup is blood. you're signaling us loud and clear there's a big punch coming here. What can Israel and the Palestinians learn today from this play that you have and this life that you've mused over and thought deeply into for so many years?
Look, I am a writer. Writer's wisdom is very different from politician's wisdom. Writers have always proposed very humane kind of solutions to difficulties, mm-hmm. which politicians find impractical. So I don't know that it's, I have no recommendation to either the Israeli or the Palestinian leaders as to what they should do. Their art form is a different one from mine.
And you are wholly justified. And right there, it's been a great hour. I enjoyed the play in the theater. I've so enjoyed having you, Annette Miller, here doing it for us in the studio. It's a privilege. Daniel Gaudron, congratulations on a wonderful staging.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being us tonight. Daniel Gaudron is director of Golda's Balcony. Annette Miller, thank you beyond words for coming in and sharing that with us.
Thank you so much for giving us this opportunity.
And William Gibson, the writer whose responsibility goes just so far, and it's gone a long way here tonight, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
If you're in the Boston area, Golda's Balcony will be playing at the Tremont Theater until February 22nd. Go to our website for more details. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
Our work is steadily progressing and should be allowed to run its natural course. These few months, in my view, would be a valuable investment in peace because they could help us avoid a war.
The issue is not how much more time the inspectors need to search in the dark. It is how much more time Iraq should be given to turn on the lights and to come clean. And the answer is not much more time.
Those two threats, terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, are not different. They're linked. And dealing with both of them is essential for the future peace and security and prosperity of the world.
If we indict Saddam Hussein on the grounds that he has failed to disarm in accordance with the United Nations resolutions, how then can we turn around and act against him without United Nations support?
What I'm condemning is that one power with a president who has no foresight, who cannot think properly, is now wanting to plunge the world into a holocaust.
In all these days of promise and days of reckoning, we can be confident. In a world of change and hope and peril, our faith is sure. Our resolve is firm, and our union is strong.
2 years ago, the federal budget was in surplus. Now this administration's policies will produce massive deficits of over $1 trillion over the next decade. These policies have powerful and painful consequences. States and cities now face our worst budget crises since World War II. We're being forced to cut vital services from police to fire to health care, and many are being forced to raise taxes.
Citizens of Israel, the election is over, said Sharon. The time for arguments is over. Now is the time to work together. I am hereby announcing that when the president gives me the task of forming the next government, I will call on all Zionist parties to join in a broad government of national unity.
Reed will now spend the rest of his life in prison, unable to fulfill his delusional quest to destroy democracy and the United States of America in the name of religion. Richard Reed's closing threat did not frighten our court, nor does it deter us from our pursuit of justice.
And there's a week, Nuclear Inspector in Chief Mohammed El-Baradei imploring the world to give weapons inspectors in Iraq one more chance. Secretary of State Colin Powell responds by saying Iraq's time is running out. British Prime Minister Tony Blair, meeting today with President Bush, says dealing with Saddam Hussein is essential to the war on terror, but he still wants another UN resolution. Dissent in the Senate, Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia proposes a bill that would require President Bush to seek a fresh vote at the United Nations. South Africa's Nelson Mandela rips into President Bush for threatening war with Iraq. President Bush says the State of the Union is strong in his annual address. In the Democratic response, the governor of Washington State, Gary Locke, says the state of the U.S. economy is in shambles. Ariel Sharon, reelected prime minister in Israel, and Richard Reed is sentenced to life in prison for attempting to blow up an airplane with explosives hidden in his shoes last December. Jack Beatty, it's all about inspections and war.
It is. And, you know, thinking about this, the full evidence of these weapons, whether they're there and how many are there, will only come after the war, which raises a question, a series of them. What if we don't find the evidence to justify the war we have just made? What if Saddam destroyed his weapons of mass destruction and his stonewalling of the UN over the years and the inspectors now was a bluff? One that backfired by provoking the attack it was meant to deter. Or what if, as Senator Lugar asked last summer, the successor Iraqi regime wants to preserve the weapons and hides them from us? Or what if, finally, as the CIA predicted last fall, Saddam, concluding that an attack was inevitable, gave quantities of the weapons to terrorists to attack the United States? In that case, we will have fought a war for almost worse than nothing, you know, making it not only a crime to have killed people for that reason, but a blunder, potentially the most catastrophic in U.S. history.
But of course, these are what-ifs. You know George Bush wants to hold up the bloody head of the snake and say, here it is, we found it. It may well be, just as well, I suppose, that that the intelligence that they're not sharing is exactly the location of those same weapons.
Well, then I think he really, to get European opinion and to legitimate this war in world opinion, he needs to produce, Colin Powell needs to produce some of that evidence at the UN.
Coming up next week, all eyes will be on that, February 5th, to hear exactly what evidence he has to share. The inspectors giving a kind of mixed message this week, enough for Washington to say we're pressing forward toward war, enough for Europe to say let's keep inspecting.
Yes, and Hans Blix in the today's New York Times says he wants the inspections to go on. He says, I've seen there was nothing in my report to justify a war. Let's let this run on. And point by point, he disputed claims that the Bush administration had made about his report and about what they indicated. So this war of, you know, what's propaganda and what's a truth claim here goes on, even between the inspectors and the Bush administration.
And spreads. Nelson Mandela chiming in this week with a very harsh condemnation of President Bush. This is a man old enough not to care about consequences.
Yeah, and with an immense moral authority, he needs to be listened to.
Well, perhaps. Jack, thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend.
Thank you, and you too.
Listeners, a great weekend to you as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is W.